Let's get going. I know a lot of people haven't seen each other for a while and are catching up. It's really incredible to have this group of people in the room and also to have this as a wider event. So tonight's event is hosted by the LSE Department of Psychological and Behavioural Science as an open public event. But it's also, the opening keynote of our conference, which is sponsored by the EASP and SPISI, entitled Society in the Classroom, Integrating Perspectives on How Socioeconomic Inequalities Unfold in Educational Settings. With that in mind, the hashtag is Society in the Classroom, hashtag Society in the Classroom, and tonight's talk is also being recorded, audio recorded, for distribution beyond that. So all I'm going to do is introduce our keynote speaker, who we're delighted to have. Hazel Rose Marcus is the Davis Brock Professor in the Social Sciences at Stanford University, also Faculty Director of SPARC, which stands for Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions. We're going to hear a lot about the work of SPARC today, so I won't go into that now. Just a little bit about Hazel's background. She did her PhD at the University of Michigan, where she went on to join the faculty. After around 20 years, she moved to Stanford and has since had an extremely distinguished academic career. Hazel is one of our most inspirational and successful and well-known and well-loved psychologists. Resulting in an unsurprising set of awards and distinctions. Hazel's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the British Academy, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and has won numerous awards. The list of awards in your CV was too long to go through, so I'll just highlight the big ones. APA Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award, the Donald T. Campbell Award from the Society of Personality and Social Psychology for contributions to social psychology, and also APS's William James Award for Lifetime Achievement. And why is this? Because Hazel's work has been seminal. It really has pivoted our field. I mean, it just changed the way our field was moving. I first came across Hazel's work when I was a student here, a master's student learning about cognition and culture, and everything began with her 1991 article with Shinobu Kitayama, where she made what seems an obvious point now, and that's just a sign, how obvious it is a sign of the influence it had, that there's not just one way to be, that perhaps the way we think of ourselves as predominantly Western middle-class psychologists, we ourselves as independent, individual selves, detached from our social relationships, impinged on by the outside, is just one particular way that might be coming out of a particular cultural context. That if we shift cultural context, and also we don't just shift norms, values, ways of behaving, and we also shift our very understanding of our sense of self. So it might be that the social, you know, as is kind of, you know, a classic observation in social psychology, that the sense of self comes through engagement with others, the notion of the self as interdependent really captures this notion of the self being constructed by social contexts and cultural contexts. And if our sense of self changes when culture changes, then everything's up for grabs, really. We really need to rethink everything about how we've been doing psychology, and that's what happened in the 30 years since that article. But that wasn't enough. You've carried that through. I mean, one way in which that we'll focus on in the next few days in particular, in which that matters, is in thinking about how the sense of self also shifts across social class contexts, and notions of interdependence are also tied to aspects of growing up in working class contexts. I first actually met you, Hazel, at an SPSB symposium on social class, and it was a bunch of us congregated after to talk about why psychology isn't studying social class and how finally this is happening. Obviously, also, and thanks in huge part to the work of Hazel's student, Nicole Stevens, who's here and co-organizing the conference. And what's interesting there is that when you move from thinking about culture to thinking about social class, you complicate culture and you make it more than just a set of symbols or values. You embed it in material context, in institutional context, as well as, of course, in interpersonal relationships. And so with that, the last time I was on the stage with you was when I was discussant, when you were coming to talk about your book, Clash, with Alana Connor. And that is really trying to make this bold claim of saying, well, maybe a lot of the differences across a whole load of categories, ethnic, gender, class, culture, are down to power and resource differences. And that's trickier. That's a little bit more controversial than just talking about culture. But bold, because it means that to the extent that culture is involves material context, involves power differences, then if we want to intervene to improve psychological outcomes or to improve behaviors, we need to think about intervening at these levels, at these higher levels of analysis. That's what we'll be grappling with over the next few days, and I couldn't think of anyone better to start us off than Hazel to come and speak with us about how she's trying to do that at SPARC. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jennifer, for that very generous and also intellectually rich, and I would say, from my point of view, precise understanding of what I'm trying to do. I would like many of my colleagues to be able to do that introduction. It was really good. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to have been invited to start off this conference that you're doing, and the work that's happening with you and Nicole and Sebastian is just amazing. So what I do, Okay, I thought everything was so ready. I want to talk today about research that we're doing to build a psychology of society and what we're learning from our experiences, I should say, in the field. A psychology of society, I have discovered, goes by a variety of names these days: public psychology, practical psychology, sociocultural psychology, societal psychology. Here are some of the features that are highlighted in many of these types of psychology. And when I talk about a psychology of society, when you talk about it here, I think we're talking about a psychology that centers social problems, that engages diverse publics in knowledge creation, that attends to significant societal distinctions, social class, race, ethnicity, gender, from the start, communicates and democratizes psychological knowledge, focuses on intentional cultural societal change, and in the process of this rethinks what constitutes psychology. And I have here just a handful of references that I would think would be essential references in talking about societal psychology. It's obvious, I hope, that LSE has always been at the center of this kind of psychology called societal psychology. And I've had the very good opportunity to meet and learn from leaders in the field of societal psychology connected with LSE: Hilda Himmelweit, Rob Farr, Sandra Jakelovich, and now that base on, and you're building on top of it. I think there's a very, very bright future here. And what I want to talk about is what I've done in the past decade with my colleagues to build a center at Stanford that we call SPARC. And this is what we say. We call ourselves a behavioral do tank. We also try to think, but we're trying to move ourselves towards more action research. And we're building research-driven partnerships with industry leaders and organizations, and our focus is on combating bias, reducing disparities, and driving culture change. And we're working in the areas we have here: criminal justice, economic mobility, education, health, and media. And my claim today is that although psychology, our field, has always struggled with this binary between basic and applied, that this binary often dissolves or gets blurrier anyway when researchers and practitioners work in collaboration to address social problems. In some cases, the science does provide approaches and answers to applied problems, to be sure, but in many cases, what you find is those very messy worlds of police departments, classrooms, community organizations, doctor's office, executive suites, present basic psychological problems as well as ways to address them that can fuel the science, that can expand in psychology as we know it, basic psychology. So at SPARC, we've been working in these variety of domains, and our vision is to get more science into the world and also more of the world into the science. And here, with a focus of getting more of the world into the science, I'm going to talk about a number of projects that, four actually, that we've co-developed with a variety of partners, including a nonprofit carrying out basic income trial in Kenya, a police department in California, a media platform, and a school district in Oregon. And everything I'm going to talk about here is a major team effort, and I only have room on the side for so many, but I want to call out on the top left is Professor Jennifer Eberhardt, who's a co-faculty director with me of Stanford SPARC, and her work has been the source of so much of what we've done and so much of the interest in the work. And then on the top right, Mariam Hamadani, who is the executive director of SPARC and is the force behind everything at every level, the planning, the funding, the research itself. So, and then plenty of other people that I'll talk about when I talk about the various projects. As I describe these projects and show you some data and some of our learnings, I hope you will see, or hope it will be clear, that inequality is a through line in this research. Inequality and scarcity of materials, resources to be sure, but also psychological inequality, by which I mean inequality and scarcity in understanding, in recognition, and respect. And these inequalities need to be addressed simultaneously with economic inequality if we're going to have the kind of good outcomes that we want from our various efforts at intervention and culture change. Much of the work I'm going to talk about in these four examples has come to us as partners have asked us to help with culture change. Most recently, there are calls throughout the U.S. for culture change that reflects, you know, terrible events that have reeled the world, the use of force by the police, racial justice uprisings, the Me Too movement, the global pandemic. You can see on this slide some headlines that I've picked from the morning newspapers here. Culture seems to be the problem. America has a culture problem. Tech has a culture problem. Hollywood has a culture problem. The police has a culture problem. Everybody's got a culture problem. We've got that straight. But then when it comes to, well, what exactly is culture and what are we going to do to fix it, then there's less that's out there. And so I think with all of you, we're trying to enter into that problem of psychology of society. And for many years and with many colleagues, I've tried to develop a more comprehensive psychology, one that takes account, as Jennifer so nicely said, of people and cultural context outside the middle class West. And we've tried in our work to distribute the idea of people as socioculturally shaped shapers. And in doing this work, we've used two theoretical tools that I'm just going to cover briefly because we've used them in the interventions I talk about. The first one is the culture cycle. It's a conception of culture as a set of four nested levels or planes that are mutually reinforcing. The culture cycle it's an iterative. Just does that every once in a while. Okay, it's an iterative recursive process by which first people create the cultures to which they later adapt, and second, cultures shape people so that they act in ways that perpetuate their cultures. In other words, people and culture, and I think some other primates as well, make each other up. And, you know, I can see where Jean-Claude, I can hear him saying, oh, do you mean Bourdieu? Yeah. I mean, you know, this is an attempt to take a lot of these ideas and to simplify them for presentation so people can understand culture in terms of the four eyes. But I know my sources. I know my intellectual ancestors, okay? So there they are. The process involves individual selves here in blue, thoughts, feelings, and actions of individuals, then interactions in red. Those are everyday practices, norms, artifacts that reflect and promote those selves. Then institutions in green, institutions such as the economic system, education, law, the media, that afford or in some cases discourage certain types of practices and artifacts. And then at the final level over here, though, in the orangey-yellow color here, are pervasive ideas, social representations, narratives about what's good, right, self-valued, what's of worth, what's human in a given context. And of course, all of those levels influence and are influenced by each other. I would say none of them are theoretically prior. They're just all important. To simplify it, say if you think of a child born in the U.S. today, and they will become an American because the people, products, organizations, and institutions that they interact with, their family and friends, their schools, their media, the legal system, will see them as an American, teach them how to be an American, treat them what they like, what they understand an American to be. And of course, as you know, there's vast variety in what people think an American should be these days. But as a result of participating in this culture cycle, that child will inhabit American cultural worlds and be shaped by them. And I hope it's clear that what I'm doing in this conception of culture is fusing the structural and the agency together, not making that separation. I know that's fighting words in some territories, but I'm just being clear about what I'm thinking here. Several things to note real quick. People, individuals are part of their cultures. They're not separate from them. Also, cultures are products of human agency. We made them, maybe not us individually in here, but certainly the people related to us have made them. And what that means is that culture change is possible. I'm not saying it's easy or that we've succeeded in doing it yet, but clearly it is possible. So then I want to talk about one other theoretical tool that we've used in that work. And that's been the framework of independence and interdependence. So these culture cycles, they do a lot of significant work for us. One very impactful thing that they do is answer this question of who am I and what am I doing? And different culture cycles encourage particular and often quite different ways of being a good or valued or normatively appropriate person or agent or self. And so here are two, not the only two, but two models of agency, of self, of personhood that are common in the world. What I want to say is this one on the left over here is the independent one is the dominant model in most of our social sciences, in most lay thinking in the West. That's the model that's out there. These two models are alike. They each show you in the middle, surrounded by important others. We're a social species. For however you think about yourself, others matter. The models are similar, but they're different in how the you relates to the other people. The one on the left here is a model that's as a common in much of the college-educated West. This model says that if you want to know what a person is, you should know what's inside that person, and what's inside that person is personal interests, preferences, goals, passions. That's what matters most. That's what we understand as what drives behavior. The part in blue is emphasized. On this other side, on the interdependent side, this is a model of self that's common in many low-income working-class contexts in the West, also in many contexts, maybe most other contexts outside the West. Here it is. What's different is the nature. The self depends not on what's inside, but the nature of your relationships with others, roles, responsibilities, others' expectations, what other people think of you, whether they respect you, whether they think you're a person of worth. That's what's extremely critical in driving behavior. And that's what we don't have enough emphasis on in the West, and I want to talk about that today. And these different selves are shaped up by different culture cycles, and they make a difference for all aspects of behavior. And there are culture cycles of nation, of region, of social class, of ethnicity, of a race, of occupation, of organization. There, culture cycles role for all of these different things. Just very quickly, this is an analytic tool. Of course, people have access to both of these ways of doing. Some people are very independent in their professional or working worlds, and they go home and they're completely interdependent with family, for example. But the relative balance between these two ways, and of course there are other ways, in any given cultural context, we find is a useful way to help you figure out what kind of culture change might be necessary here or what sorts of things you might want to emphasize in a given intervention. So now the four projects that I put them together because they showcase interventions at different levels using different measures and methods. And I think if you put them all together and you look, it sort of makes me think that cultural change, intentional cultural change, is possible. But I don't want to overclaim about any of them at the start. The first one is one on in the area of economic development. And this is a project that the first part of it is done at the ideas level of the culture cycle. It was done in Nairobi, Kenya, and our partner was the Busera Center for Behavioral Economics, and our team leader was Catherine Thomas. She'd worked for many years as a research assistant at Busara, so she had good connections. She was already, they already thought well of her. And this organization has, like so many organizations, and Catherine Thomas, by the way, just has finished her PhD, and she'll start at the University of Michigan in the following year. What Bhusara has discovered is governments, NGOs, multilateral organizations, they spend over $130 billion globally on aid per year. But most of these programs are only partially effective. They don't feel like they're capitalizing on everything that's going into it. And so the problem was, you know, what could be done? What else could be added to these economic development programs that might have them help them realize their potential? There's lots of problems why the programs don't work. First of all, people don't stick to the programs, even in cash transfer programs, and they don't take them up in the first place is another problem. There's lots of reasons for this failure. Lots of times, the obvious one is that the programs aren't sufficiently responsive to the really severe structural constraints of those living in poverty. That's always one. But another one, which I think is much less well examined, is that these programs may not be psychologically and culturally attuned. And I think that's where we come in, and we have a lot to offer to the economists on this front. And so in this project, we looked at the culture cycle. I've highlighted the two areas. We first looked at the ideas level, then we looked at the interactions level. And the first thing we did is recognize that providing aid is an economic transaction, but it's much more than an economic transaction. It's also a social and cultural interaction. And while aid offers the recipients material support, it, in so doing, without saying explicitly, it also offers a narrative to recipients about who the recipients are, what they are capable of, and how they are seen by others in the community and society. And despite the very best of intentions, the narratives that accompany aid, whether, you know, often quite implicitly, often perpetuate very negative stereotypes of low-income aid recipients as lazy, as irresponsible, as dependent, or as lower capability than other people. So the idea here was, you have to think about how is the aid being represented, and is this undermining the outcomes of recipients? And at the same time, is it also undermining the political will of people who also hold these views to do something to address poverty? And so what we were thinking is that these narratives themselves can contribute to perpetuating cycles of prejudice, stigma, as well as poverty and inequality. So before we began with a field experiment in Kenya, in which we framed this aid in terms of independence or interdependence, we first looked at an initial study with the names and the mission statements of the organizations themselves. We noticed that the very names and communications of these organizations about aid often signaled or outright declared helplessness, low agency, neediness, and marginal social status. So we coded the first, the mission statements of the top 30 international aid organizations. What we found is that 97% of them are poverty focused. So what do they emphasize? They emphasize these are ultra poor households that will get the help. They're beneficiary households. They're near the poverty line. They have risky coping strategies. I'm just filled with this sort of language. It's also the case that they, some of them, more than half, say something about empowerment, what's in red. So they understand that they want to release the productive capacities of people, offer solutions. They want to improve community livelihood assets. But as you can see, with the green font, they're also reinforcing the idea that these are poor and needy people. And we found that, you know, this was not just these international aid programs that are concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. When you start looking at other programs, TANF, which is the major name of the program for U.S. welfare, its name is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And then you have the Food for the Poor over here in the New York Times, the Neediest Cases Fund. Save the Children is a big fund. They're always advertising on various television in the evening. Help the Poor Victims, the Red Cross. So you have to think what's going on here. Now, of course, these mission statements aren't probably primarily for the recipients, okay? Very importantly, they are for the donors. And donors, when you give, you like to think that you're doing something good, and it makes you feel better if you think you're doing it for needy and poor people that have to be saved. But the point is, that's not the only people that are getting the messages out there. Recipients are getting the messages as well as other people, and you know, setting up whose problem is this poverty anyway. So that was the first thing we did in this study. Then we moved to the interactions level, and we worked with economists to carry out an experiment that gives unconditional cash transfers to low-income individuals through a nonprofit called Give Directly. And here you can see an example. Here's a woman receiving cash via mobile money on her phone. And there are many aid programs in Kenya that are now delivering aid in this way. They are the seat of cash transfer programs, having realized in international aid that giving people cash is actually the best thing you can do. Not come up with a program that you think they need. Just give them the money and they figure it out. But still, these programs aren't as fully effective as they could be. And our goal is to think if we could do an experiment would help the people designing these programs deliver in a way that didn't stigmatize and would instead empower people in a culturally resonant way. So with Busara, we set up these remote labs and community halls. And you can see here's the check-in area here. And then you can see some lab stations in these pictures. And we hypothesized that the residents, and this was done in settlements that are around Nairobi, they're low income, they're informal settlements. And we thought that participants would have a strong sense of interdependence, a sense of shared fate with close to others in such constrained, economically constrained settings. People often coordinate to achieve their goals, they share resources, and we thought they would be most practiced with an interdependent model of agency. We thought that would be most resonant for them. At the same time, we knew that in this, in these worlds where the only way really to make money is through these little micro businesses where you're selling stuff. That's pretty much what everybody is doing in one way or another, hustling one sort of product or another. Whether it's food products or other things they can find. So that means you need some kind of independence in order to operate. The informal economy is quite competitive. It's not that everybody all comes together and works together. So we weren't quite sure which one of these framings was going to work. But from previous research by people in the room, like Nicole Stevens back there in that red and black, and Rebecca, she's over there in the with her black face mask there. It's nice to only see a few of those, I can point you out. But in previous research with working with ideas of independence and interdependence on college campuses, the idea was that if you have a narrative that resonates with the models of agency that are common in people's cultural context, that's likely to be the most effective. And so we thought that overall in the low-income urban Kenyan context, we thought that narratives, first of all, that didn't tell people they were poor and needy, like those mission statements do, but then emphasized interdependence might be the most effective. So what we did in this experiment, and here are these two models here, so you could see we thought that the interdependent might be generally more effective, but we weren't totally sure about that. And then here's the sort of independent model that I described briefly. So what we did is we gave over 500 low-income participants a small cash transfer, which was equal, we just gave them the cash to be in the experiment, which was equal to 2 days' wages. And then we randomly assigned them to hear one of three audio, that contained one of three narratives about the donor organization, that kinds of organizations that usually run these cash transfer programs. And so you can see we had, this is the status quo one, which is we're gonna help you not be poor and needy. Then we gave an individual empowerment one, a community empowerment. you can see just the beginning of what we said there. It was either to alleviate poverty and reduce financial hardship among the poor, individual empowerment. We said the goal of this individual empowerment organization is to enable individuals to pursue personal goals and become more financially independent. So kind of a straight measure of independent agency. And community empowerment was the goal of this community organization is to enable people to support those they care about and help communities grow together. And we were interested because we were working with Bussard, their primary interest was, would one of these narratives help people actually use the money that was given to help them develop their own micro enterprises? So what we did was, after hearing the narratives and then hearing about the program and answering some other questions, we gave them a choice of, they could pick two of these six videos to watch. And two of the videos were soccer videos with teams that were popular. Two of the videos were of very popular soap operas. And two were of business skill videos to deliberately set up to help you develop a small business. And after these framings, we looked to see which two that people chose. And what you can see here is that this community empowerment significantly increased the choosing of the skill building videos, certainly compared to poverty alleviation, which was the status quo. Individual empowerment was in the right direction, but it wasn't didn't reach conventional levels of significance comparing it to poverty. But both of the two in empowerment conditions were somewhat effective. And I think they're important because what they didn't do, those two, is tell people that they're poor and needy. And maybe the culturally attuned one might help motivate recipients to take up these kinds of opportunities when they receive resources like cash, because many of these programs are available. We then asked, what about self-efficacy? Because whenever you work with the economists, they're sure that self-efficacy is the major thing. And you can see that, in fact, both individual and the community empowerment narratives worked for people and were much better than the status quo poverty alleviation. And then we asked, what we were very particularly interested in is stigma. And we found that only the community empowerment narrative came to significantly reduced stigma, which is how much do you feel that other people in Kenya make negative judgments about you. So like, this is the one that was dealing with this problem of feeling not respected and feeling not of worth like other people. And sort of, it's one that this is an idea that could be built on this. And so these findings, I think, suggest that there could work with develop more refined narratives, and these development initiatives could more effectively deliver aid if they paid more attention to aspects of interdependence in the setting, and also if they paid attention to deflecting the stigma that's associated with aid, and particularly with trying to accord people more respect. Okay, so next project was one on criminal justice. And this one we partnered with the Oakland Police Department in Northern California. Here we focused on police stops. These, of course, have been highly controversial in the US. It was a police stop that gave rise to the murder of George Floyd and America's latest attempt at racial reckoning. Police stops are, in fact, the most common way in which people come into contact with the police. And here this was done by Jennifer Eberhardt and Nick Camp, who's now a professor at University of Michigan. And what we know is that tens of millions of drivers are stopped each year by the police. And these interactions are highly consequential. They are the context through which trust is built or in the community or eroded, because it's not just the person that gets stopped that has these problems. It's everybody else who drives by and sees this person being stopped and is looking and then talks about it. And so it really, police stops really matter. And as we studied police culture, it became clear to us that many interventions were necessary at every level of police culture. But we started focusing at a place that we thought we could make a difference at the interactions level and the institutions level of the culture cycle. Here, the police are representatives of institutions, powerful institutions, ones that have the power to take away your life or your freedom. And then how they conduct these stops has consequences for all the community and their interactions with the community. So in one initial study, what we did is we captured footage from nearly 1,000 traffic stops conducted by 245 officers in Oakland. All the most police in the US now have to wear the body cameras. So we got the footage, and then we had to transcribe the videos to get the language. And we had 981 traffic stops stops of black and white drivers in this area. And what we did is we obtained 36,000 utterances from those stops. And the first thing we did is to hand code 400 of them for what we were seeing in them, we thought, which was differences in respectful speech and more respectful speech and less respectful speech. And I show you here the kinds of things, more formal titles, so the police will say, "Thank you, ma'am," or they'll say, "Sorry to stop you, sir," or "Thank you very much, sir," "Drive safe," "No problem." Less respectful is, "All right, my man," or "Just keep your hands on the steering wheel." "Is this your car, boss?" And then speech disfluencies often occurred when there was more in association with more disrespectful speech. And we used those results. We put our hand coding together with machine learning techniques, and we trained an algorithm to capture these differences in the respect of the language towards black and white drivers. And here's what we found. We found more formal titles for white drivers. So, "Okay, ma'am, do you have your insurance and registration, ma'am?" "All right, Mr. X, listen, I'm going to let you go with a verbal warning tonight." We found more concern for the safety of white drivers. "Okay, drive safely, all right? So I'm glad you're safe. You're cool, right? I just want you and your baby to be safe." More reassurance to the white drivers. "Yeah, don't worry about it. It's all good," or "No big deal. Just make sure you get those things fixed." When it came to the black drivers, we saw that it's not that they were so disrespectful, they were just getting much less respect. They were less likely to be given a greeting. They were much less likely to be told why they were stopped in the first place, or it came later in the interaction. And the interactions were much more informal, like, "Evening, dude, what's happening, bro?" You know, instead of using "sir" or "mister." Now, later on, the police officers, when we presented these results, they told us, well, they were just trying to be informal like the people that they were stopping. And so they just wanted to try to relate. They weren't that happy with these results with the police. But in fact, we found that police officers, when they are, even when they think they're behaving professionally, they spoke to black drivers with much less respect. In fact, white communities were 57% more likely to hear an officer say one of the most respectful utterances. Black community members are 61% more likely to hear an officer say one of the least respectful. In fact, based on the words of the officers used alone, we could predict whether the officer was talking to a black person or a white person, just with the words. So these natural language processing methods were really useful to us to make visible how our notions of race are embedded in everyday interactions. These notions get lodged into the very words that the police use and the very phrases that they use as they communicate. And I was saying, when we presented these to the officers, and they weren't too sure, you know, what they thought. When we presented them to the community members, they said, "Oh yeah, you know, we've been telling you this about the police for years. You're just getting around to telling us something that's obvious now. And then we said, yes, but we use natural language processing to find that out, you know, so couldn't just take your everyday real experience. But so then a lot of the police said, oh, researchers, you know, you guys can make those numbers say anything you want. They were very real about what they thought about our methods. But, and then other officers, as I said, thought that they were just trying to connect. They were young people with young people, and they didn't make sense to call people sir and mister. They felt that they were, you know, doing no harm, meant no harm, even if the language differed. So we wanted to find a way to present these results in a way that the officers might take them in. So they had a big training that was coming up, a procedural justice training, something that they were required to do. And so what we did is we developed a module about respectful stops, and we put it inside that training, but not just this is what you need to do. We decided to have, one important thing I forgot to tell you, that racial disparity was robust to all these kinds of controls, including the race of the officer, the severity of whatever they were being told they were being stopped for, so that was important. But we made this module, and we had Jennifer Eberhardt and Laron Jackson, who is the Oakland police chief, and they've been good friends for many years since Jennifer had the idea of using this body-worn camera footage, not as a way to call out who's done something wrong and to sanction an officer, but to actually use it as data to see what we could learn about these kinds of interactions. So Laron, what he did, he gathered from his officers all the questions they had about this study, and then he brought on a video, he asked Jennifer, you know, about these various, you know, how did she do it, and why did she think this, that, and another thing, and they talked, and this worked because they did it in the Oakland Police Department office. It was on their side, it was the officers' questions, and then as they went through the study, they ended up breaking down the stop into these five bits. The officers came up with that themselves. And then we looked, these were the five things: introduce yourself, state the reason for the stop early on, offer reassurance, use formal titles, and express concern about safety. And so they felt that they really weren't being lectured by some outside group who didn't know anything about the police. They thought they were, you know, and they felt they were participating in it, which seems to be a really important aspect of these culture change interventions, giving people voice. And this interview technique seems to work. And so now we've just finished collecting the second year of data from the same police force to see if indeed it looks like what we found from the first year, after first year, which they were doing more of all of these things. So those lessons were sticking. It looks like we have reduced the gap in respectful speech between white drivers and black drivers, and the officers seem to have incorporated this into their everyday practice. And I think another feature besides giving them voice is this idea of, you know, breaking it down into things that are very practical and that they can easily do. Okay, so next intervention was one in tech, and this was led by Xuan Zhao, and it was a study of effective inclusion training for online community moderators. And this was an inclusion or bias training, but we think of bias training here not as the cause of what's the problem, but we think of bias training as the bias as the result, as the consequence of what's going on. And we looked at a bias or anti-bias training for online community moderators, and you know, moderators are the people that watch what's going on these online platforms, and they have the responsibility to take down content or suggest that content should be taken down or even suggest that some people should not be allowed to post. This was a social media platform, I can't name the real one, but let's just call it Neighborly, and the whole idea of this community is, this platform is to build good relations among people in the neighborhood. And it's the place where you can go online and sell your used child car seat or look for a gardener or say there's going to be a block party, something like that. Now, and these platforms, as we know, they help people find community, they help people stay connected, but to say the obvious, they also create and exacerbate terrible social issues. And it turns out that all social media platforms, no matter what their original intent, even like this one, which was this great intent to build community, allow people use them to post racially and culturally biased, really disrespectful, stigmatizing content, the kinds of things that are in the air. Some people call this hate speech. Other people call it free speech. So this is a huge problem. And the idea is it's not just a problem for people who post, but it's for the people who don't post, but they just scroll through and they're just getting ideas about what the norms are for what you can say in society and what's okay to do. So it's a huge problem. You know, these are just some of the platforms that you know well. And if you look at this is daily time spent on the internet per capita worldwide. And of course this is worldwide, but what I want you to see from this is just this tremendous growth from 2011 to 2021. And according to this graph, we're spending 155 minutes on the phone every day and 37 minutes on desktop. I think most of us are doing more, but this is worldwide. And as you can see, I think you don't have to work hard to say that what's happening on these platforms is huge. That's where we are doing all of our social interaction. So we felt kind of excited by this project and kind of compelled to work on it, given our interest in mitigating bias and disparities in respect between community members. So here's just one example of the kind of thing that will be posted. Someone says on the Neighborly platform, suspicious man, did anyone see that dark-skinned man on a bike riding through the neighborhood? And so there's some people that say, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you. Some people say, oh, you know, there's just some creepy people in every community, don't worry about it. But very often someone says like this, why do you think that incident is related to race? I don't see color. So what happens, the post people deny the event that someone has just posted about, or they discount it. Someone says, my black son was just stopped by someone on the street and asked if he lives here. And someone else says, oh, I can't believe that happened. You know, so there's just, and then of course, there starts to be a back and forth among the people who are revealing, they're disclosing these discriminations, and lots of people who are trying to say, no, race isn't real, I don't see it, you're just trying to make division in the neighborhood, stop it. And then there starts to be back and forth, and some of them get really quite ugly, these back and forth. This is happening on all the social media platforms, as you know. The moderators are the front line for trying to fight bias. Sometimes they're employees, sometimes they're volunteers. In the Neighborly platform we worked with, they were volunteers. They're people who'd signed up to be the moderator for their community. And like I said before, they, you know, get to report this or to vote. But of course, when they signed up, nobody knew if they had any expertise to be a moderator or why were they signing up or what biases were they bringing to their moderation. So we partnered with the idea of doing some kind of a anti-bias inclusion training, hypothesizing that if moderators learned what people find biased or racially profiling or stigmatizing and reported it and took it down, that we could start to build some new norms on the Neighborly platform about what was, you know, the right way to behave, and maybe could make a norm cascade so people would see what sorts of things that would be better for you to save. And here we were, we knew that some platforms had done anti-bias training, but very few of them had been really empirically evaluated. And lots of times people start and then they don't want to participate. So it was a heavy lift. But we thought that we would work once again at these two levels highlighted here at the institutions and the interaction level, and we could have some effect with the training. And we Together with our partners, we help them interview and choose a leadership and inclusion consultancy. We didn't do that ourselves. We wanted to be independent from it. And this was a consultancy that customizes training programs for organizations. And the good thing about that is they made this bias training specifically for social media platforms, and the training was directed to posting and what sorts of things would be hurtful to people or not. It resulted in a hour and a half self-paced online course called Inclusive Moderation. And what was interesting about this, besides the fact that it was, you know, specific to the to online posting, is that it was run by owned by a Black woman, and her whole team were people of color. I think that might have been why it was somewhat effective. And our goal was to help people understand what could be considered offensive content. And offensive content is defined by these platforms as not civil and prejudice. There's a lot of ambiguity there. But it aims to teach moderators, this is what it was, what bias is, how bias impacts belonging, how bias can show up on the platform, how moderators can identify and address bias on the platform. And it was only an hour and a half, but these were some of the key concepts that it covered. There's lots of videos, lots of interviews with people talking about why they thought something was racially profiling or not. So it was quite engaging. And so did it make any difference? And I think we can say, yes, it did make a difference. Okay. We can see that there was indeed more sensitivity to racially biased posts, also more agreement.
Did it appear for a second?
Yeah, it's so weird. I think I'm not doing anything. I'm standing away. They were more sensitive to racially biased posts, and there were more agreement. This is the results of a composite of items, and it's so you can see that people think they come to learn that bias can reduce the sense of belonging in a neighborhood. They can see that it might be their responsibility to track it or to take it down. They also came to understand that things like the dark-skinned guy in the blue sweater walking down the street looks suspicious is racial profiling and could be upsetting to people if they don't have anything else to complain about except that. And they also came to see that claims of color blindness can be in response to these posts can be very hurtful to people, and they also started to share their norms. We also then looked at their behavioral training, and all these projects, we were trying to look for something that was quite behavioral as an outcome, and we were able to track the moderators' behavior on the platform 4 weeks before and after taking the course, and we found that they reported more posts in the offensive category related to the training: uncivil, prejudice, not suspicious. They used words like microaggression that they learned in the training. So some learning was taking place. And we also had a nice control condition. We looked at the number of reports that moderators made about complaints like that server was really rude to me in the Wendy's. You know? So there, we weren't just getting more complaints about having the moderators take down more complaints overall. They were ones that were relevant to the bias and inclusion training. And this is what we sort of set of conclusions here, that we were able to increase awareness of bias and racial profiling. There was more readiness and intention to counter bias, more sensitivity, and more engagement generally. Okay, so now on the last one I'm going to talk about is one that we call the missing ingredient to make U.S. classrooms culturally inclusive, and that was interdependent practices. And this was the team leader here was Stephanie Freiberg, who I think some of you know used to be at the University of Washington, now at the University of Michigan. And Stephanie gave a talk to a whole set of school superintendents in Seattle. And a number of them, she talked about culture change in schools and what was necessary, and a number of them volunteered their districts to be in a culture change program. And we chose to work with the Forest Grove District in Portland, Oregon. And here are some demographics from that district. The teachers in this area are mostly white, and the students are now 60% not white. They're mostly Latinx. The Forest Grove area, which is about 40 minutes outside of Portland, has become a wine growing area, very successful wine growing area. So many people who are experienced with agricultural work and their families who've done this kind of labor have moved to the Forest Grove area and settled there. Most of them are from Mexico. The big problem is a huge culture clash in the classroom. And it's because the majority of the white teachers, who themselves tend towards more independent ways of being from their own family socialization, and who have been trained with an independent model of self, and they're teaching with practices that are infused with this idea of independence as the right way to be, and they also are using materials, curricula, that are saturated with these ideas, aren't a good match for low-income Latinx students who tend to come from much more interdependent backgrounds and have much more familiarity with these ways of being. The superintendent and the teachers knew they were failing at motivating the students in the classroom. They weren't connecting with the families at all. And we thought that some more interdependent teaching practices might help soften this clash, and also could accord some more recognition and respect to the Latinx students and to their family. This was our most ambitious cultural change project. We tried to work at all of these levels, and we tried to work with a model of change like this. You know, at the individual level, we wanted to enhance their performance. That's what the superintendent was interested in. We wanted to reduce achievement or opportunity gaps. We wanted to increase identity, safety, and belonging. And we wanted to do it by giving teachers more understanding of minority and low-income students and teach them about more inclusive practices that would make these students feel more like school was a place for them, that they were not a guest in someone else's house, but they were actually at home in school, like many of the white students feel. And we did this through leadership level cultural inclusion training. And what this was is that we, the superintendent gave professional development money that he used, and this was a train the trainer program. So each of the 9 schools in the district were asked by the superintendent to send a leadership team of 4 to 5 people to the cultural inclusion training. And as I said, they were paid for their time. So 2 of the principals were Latinx, and 5 of the teachers were, so this helped this training, I think, be successful. And the lectures were in a variety of things. It was over 4 days. To begin with, there are some videos on cultural variation and cognition, emotion, and motivation, and consequences for curricula and classroom structure. We sort of gave them a mini course, cultural psychology for Latinx contexts, and it was tailored to the classroom. And that was in the morning. And then they spent the afternoon in teams from their schools, sort of brainstorming various ways that they could incorporate some of these ideas into the school practices. We talked about how low-income Latinx families might be more familiar and practice with interdependence rather than the default practices that are part of most classroom still to this day. We talked about how some students might, you know, be reticent to speak up in class or to read out loud, about how students prefer working in groups or collaborating with one another, at least at first. We talked about how in Latinx contexts, how important the family was, and how Latinx parents, unlike many Anglo-American families, accept the authority of the teacher. The teacher's the experts. They're not going to come up to school and give their opinion on what should be going on in the class, like so many parents, white parents, feel comfortable to do, at least, you know, upper middle class white parents feel comfortable to do that. We talked about how families might not want to come to school. Most often the messages or the bulletins sent out were not in Spanish. They didn't know what they were going to do when they came to school. So we talked about lots of things like that in the training. And then we, in the afternoon, we let them figure out how they might do this. So these were sort of the key concepts that we are emphasizing there. And we gave them, as part of their exercise, a blank culture cycle. And together in their teams and working with other teams, they had to identify a few practices that they would try to implement into the culture of their school. These were four or five people that had to go back to schools where there were usually like 35 people and try to talk to the other teachers and break things down so that the teachers could find various things that they could do to build into the school culture cycle some ideas for sustainable change. But once again, we are giving them the voice, the same thing like we did with the police. We weren't telling them this is what to do because, you know, we're not experts on that. And this is the first cohort participated in the training session in 2017. We collected data from teachers and students on 2018. Then in the second cohort, we gave them the training program, and the first cohort participated in a booster, and then we collected data again, and then of course came COVID, so we had to wait till 2021 to get performance data from the district, and we still have data to collect from teachers and families. But I'm just going to show you two types of outcomes very, very quickly here. The first one is we went into the classrooms to observe what our training and the teams working together to come up with ideas, what impact it might have had. And we looked at the physical layout and particularly the bulletin boards. And you saw that they took these ideas of representing family to heart, recognizing all students and their families, putting students in the family context. These are just, you know, lovely. Teachers got into it. They understood they should share about their families if the students were sharing about their families. A lot on inclusive class commitments, so in Spanish and in English. I will help my community and make my family proud as much as I can. Recognizing all students' progress, not just putting a couple of the stars on the board. This was in the music class, all the kids holding the bow the right way. Collective artwork, so the students together made something that was more than the sum of its parts. Lots of interdependent representations of student potential. We are a team. We respect each other. We take risks. A lot of we focus on student rights and responsibilities, but also you have the right to a good education. You have the responsibility to do your best. Rights are really big in an independent model of agency. Rights usually fall out. I mean, responsibilities usually fall out. So the idea that, you know, you have responsibilities to do something, you have responsibility to others is important. Attentive listening, appreciative, no put downs, the right to pass, mutual respect. Here was a good one. I thought this teacher put respect, and then they had to put stickies. What does respect look like? What does it sound like? What does respect feel like? Innovative, then lots of school-wide inclusive guidelines. So they really took the message to heart, at least putting it in the physical environment of the classroom. And then in the high schools, you saw more stuff on role models and inclusive social justice artwork, that sort of thing. This one I really like. The school already said the first step in winning is believing you can, and then they crossed it out and put we on top of it on the field there. So those were outcomes at the cultural artifact level. And now just a couple of things on the teacher attitudes and the student achievement. We found that following the intervention, teachers scored higher on multiculturalism. So things like of the many difficult issues schools face, increasing racial ethnic diversity among this teaching staff is an important goal for my school to pursue. This was a big change because this is quite a conservative area where lots of people, even though 60% of their students are students of color, they're not so sure why they should diversify the staff. Same thing, the school curriculum should be expanded, just that they were moving in that direction. I mean, teachers generally are higher on these kinds of things than your average person, but still, it wasn't so clear. The yellow is from the boost, the group that got the boost, as well as the first time training. The red is the one time training, and the blue is for the controls schools. And you can see that the effect of the intervention was stronger in the schools with more racial minority teachers, not surprising, where there are a few racial minority teachers, not so strong. The intervention was stronger in the school with more racial minority students. It's a bigger problem. Teachers probably felt more motivated to do something about it than the students with fewer racial minority students. Same with low income. Teachers moved most in their attitudes when there were more low income students in the school than when schools had fewer. We gave a scale that we made of interdependent teaching practices. It had three factors, 18 items: building student interdependence, building cultural background and awareness, classroom management. And what we found is that as teachers scored higher on the answering, yes, I do these things in my classroom, that those that was related positively to a variety of student outcomes: identity, safety, trust in teachers, academic engagement. And all of these factors also predicted better performance on standardized tests of math, language, reading, and writing for the students. And one thing we're exploring was especially strong effects of validating the cultural backgrounds of the students on closing the racial achievement gap that's there in math. And so that was promising, and we're looking more into that. So a couple of things I just want to say by way of conclusion here. I didn't mean to go there. I'm going too ahead of myself here. I got two other things that I wanted to say. And one is that I think what we see here in all of these four projects is this scarcity of recognition and respect. And that was built into narratives of aid. It was built into how police speak to drivers. It was part of how neighbors respond to their other neighbors on the platform, and how schools respond to students and families who are different from the students and families that they have been used to dealing with, the white teachers in most of these schools. And once again, I want to emphasize, I think this matters because respect is more of an interdependent sort of idea. You can't make it up by yourself. Respect has to be conferred by others, and it suggests that you are valued, you're of worth, you matter. And wherever you find, I think, resentment, distrust, disengagement, you're going to find some level of not full respect, not full recognition and respect. And I think we could do much more and more practice by bringing respect, which is sort of an interdependent practice more generally, into our very independent systems, which, as I say, is not very much built into our independent culture cycles. So notes for the field, there's so many notes, but just a few that I put here that runs through all of them. I think we need to begin with a partnership and a shared understanding of the problem. You have to co-construct it with a good partner, and we had that in all of these interventions. You can't just pick an organization and say, let's go do an intervention together. Very often you have to have an influential champion, someone who really believes in what you're doing and who's known in the organization. And so that's dealing with the politics. That was part of Howard's 213 article. You know, you have to understand the politics before you change. You can't avoid that. You have to really learn the culture, the history, the surrounding context. You have to examine all levels of the culture cycle and try to see which levers for change might be available. Try to fit the intervention into existing structures and mechanisms. You can see that all the things that we did were kind of, we didn't try to make any revolutionary changes there, and that was hard enough. Build in experiments and surveys to collect data at multiple levels wherever you can. That various things frustrate that, but I think, at heart we're the researchers here, and we want to be able to say, did any of these things work? And then expect backlash and resistance. It's not just you, it's part of the process, because whenever you're going to do culture change, there's going to be, there's power. Lastly, towards the psychology of society, disparities in recognition and respect for race, ethnicity, social class, they live at every level of every culture cycle you can come up with. Without attention to the cultural context, differences, whether in achievement and productivity, they can easily become in people's minds deficits if they don't understand what is the source of those differences and bring them out. Agency takes multiple forms. Psychology is still suffering from an independent bias. Interdependent agency is another common form, and there are other forms of agency as well. We have to bring those out into the light. Societal change requires continual interventions at multiple levels of culture. I mean, any of these things we've done, if we don't just go back and keep hammering on it, I don't know what will happen. More empirical work with new paradigms and methods, and I'm very keen on this idea that communications are going to be most effective when they're tailored to relevant audiences. So talk with specific ideas and practices to those who need to hear it. And it's good to try and write an op-ed for a newspaper or in our articles, but we really need to talk to teachers. They're eager to hear some practices, some interdependent practices. Even the police, if you understand who you are and in this very hierarchical organization, are willing to listen to some specific things that they would be willing to do. And I think the platform moderators too. And then finally, I have a quote from Pema Chodron here, who's an influential Buddhist thinker and writer, just to keep us going. We are at a time when old systems and ideas are being questioned and falling apart, and there's a great opportunity for something fresh to emerge. And given what's just happened in my country, I have to say that at the end, or there would be no hope. Anyway, thank you for your attention. Thank you.
So, thank you so much, Hazel. It's truly inspirational, I think, especially given one of the questions that we had toward the end of the seminar that we just had. A question came from one of our conference participants, Jungin Park, about, you know, how do we deal with this tension between the individual and the societal as the level of intervention and the appropriate place of psychology, and how hard it is to kind of be psychologists speaking to these higher levels of analysis. This level of, you know, all the research you presented is truly inspirational in terms of how we might do that. It was so much research that we have just 15 minutes, or just 14 minutes for questions. So we've got Sabrina and Julia with mics, so that we can capture... Yes, okay. And that was our fault. So that we can capture your questions for the recording, and we generally tend to introduce ourselves at the LSE before we ask questions. So feel free to gather your thoughts. I'll start with one just while people get ready to put their hands up. I was just thinking, I really appreciated what you said about implicit bias as the consequence as opposed to as the cause, because that's another one of those points of tension. And I wondered, whether you thought, I also noticed that, you know, in institutions you mentioned economic structures.
Yes.
So thinking kind of bigger scale in terms of, you know, how we organize society, how we distribute power and resources, how, you know, norms of advanced free market capitalism are shaping the way we think of ourselves. Have you thought about it, whether psychologists have any role in commenting on these?
Well, I mean, of course, because the economic structure is so foundational. I mean, you could say, let's start with undoing capitalism, and I'd be happy to have that conversation, because I do think that that's really, of course, at the heart, at the foundation of so many of those cultural cycles. I guess I'm sort of, maybe it's an age thing, but I'm starting to think, okay, let's try to work over here at some
you mean it's not gonna
levels.
Happen in our
we can do something on her that I might be alive to see or something. No, but I do think really doing the all the time thinking about what's really giving rise to these particular understandings we have about what is a person, who is of worth, who is of value, why do we decide that this is of value? In the U.S., we're much more harsh than here. We are trying to think about how to get people to think more kindly of government support. I mean, you have government support for healthcare. I was saying earlier today, even in the Biden stimulus relief during the worst of COVID, many people, even people who most needed the money, wouldn't take the money because they hate the government. And you know, they won't take anything from the government. They want to be self-reliant, even people who are not doing well. It's this model. How do we change that? You know, how do we work on that? How do we develop another narrative that everybody needs support at some time in their life? Often it's easy to fall off the path and the time where you need help. And after all, your government should. What good is a government if it's not there to support you in times of need? So that doesn't seem like a radical idea to me. It's not a radical idea in Europe or here, as I understand it. In the U.S., it's become a radical idea. So we have a lot of work to do, but I take your point.
Culture change at the societal level.
Yes, exactly. How do you build those other narratives so people can think differently, you know?
So let's hear from the audience in terms of what this made you think of and what questions you have. Yeah, I can see one here, maybe in orange.
Are we supposed to stand up? Hi, I'm Deborah. I'm a postdoctoral scholar at Northwestern University. And yeah, I think going off of what you were just talking about as to why some of these structures are already put in place, a lot of it is because of capitalism and what is considered to be beneficial, or like money, we'll make money, right? And so when you're coming into these spaces and trying to create change and create these interventions, like how much like of that do you have to frame it as, oh, this is going to be beneficial like economically, or this is something that you should really care about like economically, versus how much people are actually caring about the people itself, or right? And how do you reconcile that when the overall culture, society, that's already what's in power, and that's why it's like perpetuated?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that you can't ignore the politics, the economic systems, but you to have any effect at all, I think we've begun to think that you have to see what people who you're working with care about. So, for example, the police, most of them joined, become an officer because they wanted to help people. They wanted to do something good for their community. It gets perverted along the way. But since they have that, if you have someone who, in this case, for example, their police chief, talk to them about this is a way to really stand behind what they thought they were doing when they put the badge on. That's how it worked. I mean, it's far from thinking that the problem here is capitalism or talking about the economic system to them. That's not going to work. Many police are quite, quite conservative. They vote conservatively. They, you know, you just can't go there. But I think that you can go with what some of their appealing to their values and to their identities, what it means to them, you can make some progress. But I take your question. I understand the point.
Yeah. Is it, you have a question? Go for it.
This works perfect. I'm Sabrina Paywand. I work for World Works Center here in the UK, looking at how to prevent youth violence. And I have read a lot of Jennifer Eberhardt's work. And one problem that I keep encountering is the fear to tackle a problem on the wrong step of the cultural cycle. So taking the step on an individual level or an interaction level, for example, working with the police, building more trust, when for some communities it's plain dangerous to trust the police, how it's institutionally set up. So I was wondering whether you could elaborate a bit about these thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question too, and certainly in the Oakland Police Department, with the community there, you know, many people would like to abolish the police, and that's a huge movement altogether. What we're doing a study now with the community around where the police have been being more respectful in their stops to see if this is noticed, how this is being taken by the community, what else the community is thinking about the police. You're absolutely right. This is an issue. We've been able to talk to quite a few community activists. We've gone out to churches to present this work and tried to get the community to at least understand that we're trying to build trust across and ask for their suggestions about, you know, besides being disrespectful in the stops, what else would they like to see the police refrain from doing this sort of thing. But, you know, it's this tension between working at the these smaller levels that you can actually put your get some grasp on and doing the other things. But you know, can't give up.
It's a tricky one for sure.
Yeah.
Thanks for a great talk, Hazel. I'm Josephine de Leersnijder from the University of Leuven. And I've been doing several interventions myself, inspired by the work of you and some of the great colleagues here in the room. And what I often encounter, and especially among people who have read already a bit into cultural studies and stuff like that, is some type of resistance against the idea that we can focus on just one aspect of what it, of our cultural surroundings and cultural being. So they then really say, like, well, we are all intersectional, and of course we all operate at the crossroads of many different sociocultural contexts. But then they use that argument of intersectionality to really discard the idea that we should work on creating a more inclusive culture, for instance, on an ethnic cultural dimension or on the gender dimension and stuff like that. So I was just curious what your response usually is to that type of resistance, because I assume you got
it's,
that
it's
type
constant.
Of things
That's
before.
Why I said the you have to know that you're going to get the backlash no matter what. If you don't get the backlash, then don't you haven't done anything. And I think some of the backlash is right. Some of the backlash is like, you know, who are you to intervene in the first place? You know, it's a very kind of out of a independent model of agency. You're going to go in and move things around and make them, you know, better. And isn't that just a very colonial mindset? Haven't we done all that? You know, I get that. I can go with that critique, and I could also go with this critique that, well, it's only one of all these systems. And I do think the way to think of us all as nodes in many, many intersecting culture cycles, that's true. But I guess it's the analytical social psychologist who breaks things down into two by twos that think, well, okay, let me get a hold of one of them and see if we could, you know, make a change in that one, and maybe it would ripple out or cascade into some of the others as well. But yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't talk about men and women police officers. I didn't really even talk about race in the Oakland Police Department. I mean, they have 30% black officers, which is pretty good for a police department in the US, but many of those officers are really, you know, high on the law and order, and this is the way they have to do it. So it's not simple. And once again, I understand exactly the resistance, but as I said, I think at Spark we're just trying to do some of these things, trying to do some research as we do it, because I'm now a believer in that we can inform psychological theory by doing this rather than just doing, you know, our MTurk studies with our white middle class, you know,
totally
people.
Agree with that.
So.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Britt. I'm a postdoc at Princeton University, and I was wondering about all kinds of counterintuitive solutions to some of these problems. For example, in the police experiment, so it's kind of hard to feel respected when some people like plainly do not respect you or have some biased attitudes and stuff like that. And I was trying to think if there's other solutions than just like superficially telling them to call the other like people of color sir and stuff like that, but maybe like empowering police officers. So I think ironically, a lot of them feel restricted and that they cannot like do what they need to do, and they genuinely feel threatened. And if they have more, I don't know, responsibility, you're a leader, you mm-hmm. have the power, stuff mm-hmm. like that, that might maybe, I don't know, like I'm interested in your, what you think about
kind
of approaches.
And you're exactly right. I mean, one of the things that you will find, and the whole idea, I think, is to empower everybody. Everybody should, both the police and the drivers need, you know, more respect here. What you find in a lot of police departments is the reason they're not at all interested in their external justice and whether they're being just is because internally in the police department themselves, they don't have internal justice. They don't feel that they have voice. They don't think that they're listened to. And of course, you know, police are paramilitary organizations. You know, there's not much room for your voice. And so some of the more enlightened command staff, in which there are, it really is impressive when you get into these worlds, there are some very enlightened people, and they want to change the nature of these forces and do exactly what you're talking about, as help people do what they think they can do, which is police in their communities. Things have to change. It used to be that in many U.S. cities, you had to live in the community that you police in order to get a job as an officer. That's no longer true. And so some of those things have to be done. But I agree with you. Some of the things that are sort of straightforward, that's one way to go. But there should be, as we know from social psychology, sometimes counterintuitive things often are very effective. But once again, I think we shouldn't be afraid to get out there and try it if we don't have a well-elaborated theory and set of hypotheses. If it seems like it might work and we've got some partners that'll go with you, yeah, it's good.
So we're at the hour, but if there are one or two questions, we might be able to stretch it, but we'll get kicked out of the room.
Everybody's happy with these interventions? More controversy? No.
I'm happy, don't worry.
Okay.
I'm Holly. I'm a graduate student at the University of British Columbia. I just was curious if you could talk maybe about if you've faced any challenges, political challenges, doing this research, given the climate in the U.S., you know, people protesting, like, including critical race theory in schools, even people who don't know what that is. and I'm curious if you've run into, I could imagine if we had a room of conservatives who heard your talk, they might be pretty upset to hear about these interventions that are going on. So I'm curious if you've run into that or how you've dealt with that.
That's sort of the backlash. It's absolutely everywhere. You have to be extremely, extremely aware of the politics. And there's no sense trying to make culture change in places where the foundational ideas are opposed to what you're doing. And of course, you know, from within our psychology departments, some people are quite conservative in their views now. And they don't think that this is, you know, basic science, and you know, well, you can know the kinds of complaints that you get from this. But what I think I would try to argue that we are discovering by working with different groups, different publics, we are discovering basic psychological problems that we can solve in ways that when we're just sitting there running our own students in our own labs, or you know, doing MTurk or prolific studies, we're not doing, so we're advancing the science. But I don't think there's any getting away from those problems. Many people don't want to hear that what students need is more interdependent practices in the classroom. They want to hear that, look, you know, get competent, well-trained, smart teachers that will deliver the information, get the kids to sit up straight and take it in so they can do well on their, you know, courses, their AP exams, or we call them, you know, get them into college, teach them, even pay them to do their homework. That's what makes a good student, you know. So this whole idea that you have to, that your environment should be supporting your the way you want to be a person and should be giving you good messages about who you are and that you belong and you are of value and you deserve respect. They just think that's a bunch of nonsense, progressive liberal nonsense. So, you know, that's reality. That's not going anywhere soon in the world where I live. I did hear a conservative member of parliament earlier today talk about what he understood about social class and health and achievement, and he was, you know, I thought, is this guy conservative? I mean, I would be very happy to have that kind of person in my Congress. So, you know, that's a reality. Thank you for that question.
Looks like we got one last question.
I think I'm remembering the study correctly. Where in the Forest Grove study, where there were mostly white teachers, that the intervention didn't have as high of an effect?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you plan on continuing this work and considering that, Have you thought about how you might rephrase or adjust the intervention to address that, since we do have a lot of white teachers in schools?
That's such a great question, and I just presented just a little bit of all these things, but in those studies, we actually took evaluations on each day of the training, and we can tell exactly where in the trainings those teachers fell off. They didn't want anything to do with it. I mean, it's a lot of the white teachers want to be colorblind. It's like the people on the social media platform. They think that we're making divisions among people, making divides, when we start to say that some students and try to talk about interdependence at home and in the family and how this should be brought into the classroom. They just do not want to go that. People are people. Students are students. You can present materials in the same way for everybody. And even though you try to say that some students are so advantaged because the school matches their home, and you can just see that we're not going there. I'm going to maintain my stance of colorblindness. So it's very strong that the schools with fewer minority students and fewer minority teachers were not so keen on the interventions. So it's a very good question.
Well, we didn't expect to solve all the problems.
Oh, phew.
But I mean, in our department, we like to talk about going from the lab to the world and back. And with this conference, we're thinking about crossing levels of analysis and integrating them. And often they're just slogans until you kind of see concrete work actually trying to do these really difficult things, and to see how you haven't let go of kind of these broader structural issues. And yeah, I think it's inspirational for a lot of us, and it's kicked off our conversation for the next few days really well. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thanks to the audience. Thanks to you.